I am a commissioned officer in the United States military, and I have a pregnant woman come to me telling me that she's going to be killed, and 2 days later she's dead. At what point do I let it go?
A search for answers in the unexplained death of an Alaska Guard soldier. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 5th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, Standard & Poor's downgrades Alaska's credit rating.
In the big picture, it's just one notch, but if they don't make changes, there could be more downgrades to come.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artists Award Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
For many Alaskans, the scandal at the Alaska National Guard is over. Top brass lost their jobs after investigations confirmed a toxic work environment that harbored sexual misconduct, even crime. But nothing is resolved for the family of a pregnant soldier who died in 2011 of unknown causes. A special investigator said last summer the death deserves further review. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, soldier's family and a retired Guard officer suspect her death is related to what she knew about crime within the Guard.
Michelle LaRose Clark was 31 years old in the seventh month of an uneventful pregnancy. She collapsed on the floor at her home in Eagle River. Paramedics tried to resuscitate her. Doctors at Providence continued CPR even as they operated to remove her baby, a girl. Both died that night. The autopsy report shows Clark's cause and manner of death as undetermined. Her brother, Randy LaRose of Wasilla, says the family is torn apart.
It created not having any answers, there's so much torment in our family. I mean, if it was natural causes, I could accept that. But the fact that the autopsy and everything wasn't done right, you know, you have to question.
Clark's family does question, and after 5 years with no answers, their doubt has hardened into suspicion. They suspect the medical examiner who did not find a cause of death. They suspect the Anchorage police of not looking hard enough for answers, and because so many of them are also in the Guard. They suspect the lawyers they hired to help them get answers. They suspect Clark's husband, a pharmacy technician. They suspect murder. And Clark's brother acknowledges they have no hard evidence.
I'd give everything I had for answers.
Clark was a staff sergeant in supply at the Alaska Army National Guard, which at the time of her death was teeming with misconduct and mistrust. Clark told a chaplain's assistant she'd been raped by someone in her chain of command while they were deployed to Kosovo in 2009. And she told him the perpetrators were committing other crimes. One of the last people she approached was a National Guard officer named Ken Blaylock.
Basically, she stopped me in a hallway and asked if she could talk to me. I said yes. She had tears in her eyes. She said that she had personal knowledge of sexual assaults and drugs being dealt within her organization. She was afraid of her family. She was afraid of people in her unit. She was afraid of some of her friends. She was afraid for her life and the life of her baby.
Lieutenant Colonel Blaylock, now retired in Palmer, says during that five-minute conversation, Clark worried she'd be seen talking to him. He was, at the time, something of a clearinghouse for sexual assault victims. Blaylock says he tried to get Clark to talk to the police or a chaplain that day, the Friday before Martin Luther King Day.
I said, look, we need to go do this right now. And I was trying to convince her, and she said, no, sir, they're going to kill me.
Blaylock says they agreed to talk again after the holiday. But Michelle Clark didn't survive the weekend.
On Sunday, I got a phone call saying that she had been found dead.
Blaylock was a polarizing figure in the Guard. He got severely crossways with General Tom Katkus and other Guard leaders. Blaylock says because he was trying to address wrongdoing. He says Guard leaders portrayed him as a nut, But Blaylock says his reputation is redeemed by the investigations that confirm the guard was rife with sexual assaults, reprisals, bullying, and favoritism.
Everything else that I pushed that everybody was calling me psycho on has now been vindicated and proven to be true. So this was just another piece of it. It's not done yet.
Blaylock is pushing for more investigation. Retired Juneau Judge Patricia Collins served as a special state investigator to examine the guard. She said in her report last summer that Blaylock may be well-intentioned, but she says she didn't find evidence to support some of his allegations. Blaylock is still consumed by his suspicions of the guard and a large constellation of events he thinks are connected to Clark's death. He talks to Clark's family, who've adopted many of his allegations. They see him as a hero for trying to draw attention to her death. Blaylock says he can't drop it.
Here I am, commissioned officer of the United States military, and I have a pregnant woman come to me telling me that she's going to be killed, and 2 days later she's dead. At what point do I let it go?
Blaylock wasn't the only guardsman Clark confided in on the final Friday of her life. A non-commissioned officer who spoke on condition of anonymity to avoid reprisals agreed Clark did seem terrified. We've altered his voice.
Yeah, she was extremely afraid and extremely nervous. She didn't want to say anything on the work phone. She didn't want to say anything in the office where she was. She was extremely nervous and afraid.
He says she urgently wanted to tell him something in private. Based on prior conversations, he took that to mean she wanted to tell him about crimes within the guard.
There's people at work that she was extremely afraid of.
But unlike Blaylock, the NCO says it's likely Clark died of natural causes, which he thinks may have been aggravated by intense stress. Blaylock says there's an easy way to put all his suspicion to rest.
It's simple. Find an actual cause of death, a real one.
Tomorrow, we'll look into what's been done to find out why Clark died. For APRN, I'm Liz Ruskin.
After a small plane crashed into a downtown Anchorage building last week, much of the coverage mentioned an organization called CAP. That stands for Civil Air Patrol, a federal organization which owns dozens of planes scattered across Alaska, including the one pilot Doug Demarest flew into the building where his wife works. CAP occupies a strange space between the worlds of civilian and military aviation, one that relies primarily on self-monitoring. CAP started around World War II as a way to make use of the country's large domestic air fleet, with small planes monitoring the border and patrolling the coast for submarines. Since then, it's morphed into a program made up of about 56,000 civilian volunteers across the U.S., helping with search and rescues, flying supplies to emergency responders, and even transporting vital organs.
Basically, we're all about saving lives.
Captain Brian Emerson is a spokesperson for the Alaska wing of CAP, made up of more than 700 volunteers, only a quarter of whom are actually pilots. Many are former military or emergency responders, although Emerson says people's motives for joining vary widely.
Some people enjoy the camaraderie after they've gotten out of the armed services, of being back in the feel of that culture. Others want to continue a course of professional development. That could be as public affairs, could be finance, emergency services, as chaplain.
There's also a leadership component. Nearly 200 CAP members in Alaska are cadets, young people, ages 12 to 18. The Alaska program is designed around helping with search and rescue efforts. CAP's 28 planes are stored across the state, from Bethel to Sitka. If the organization is pinged by the Rescue Coordination Center in Alaska, a team of volunteers activates to search for a missing person or a downed aircraft. And Emerson says the CAP pilots have a good track record when it comes to safety in a state where about 22 people die each year in plane crashes.
When you're running 28 aircraft around a state, you know, certain mechanical things are going to happen. And so over the years, there have been a few minor problems that I don't think would be different than the general aviation statistics.
Emerson couldn't comment on the specifics of the recent crash in downtown Anchorage. A spokesperson for the CAP National Headquarters in Alabama, Julie DeBartoleben, says that in her 10 years with the organization, she doesn't recall any incident similar to this one in which a pilot intentionally crashed during an unauthorized flight. Pilots are required to file a flight plan ahead of takeoff. The majority of CAP's Alaska fleet, including the plane piloted by Demarest, is stationed at Merrill Field in the center of Anchorage. Merrill manager Paul Bowers says the field is designed to accommodate the general public, and entry is controlled by punch code or key card. After that, security is the purview of property owners.
So each of the tenants are responsible for controlling access to the their respective operating sites.
Bowers didn't want to give specifics on how frequently guards patrol Merrill Field, citing security concerns. Flight Tower was unmanned at the time Demarest took the plane, as it always is, before 7 a.m. The national protocol in such cases is for pilots to announce themselves over the common traffic advisory frequency on a voluntary basis. Much of the culture around small planes operates through a system of trust. One of the sources contacted for this story, who declined to be interviewed on tape, described it as, quote, a weird fraternity, one with an emphasis on safety and a presumption of good intentions. Merrill Field, the source added, is vastly more secure than most of the places small planes are stored. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a federal decision not to add wolves in Southeast Alaska to the endangered species list.
We think that the Fish and Wildlife Service didn't get it right, and that they've overlooked some important things.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
Governor Bill Walker announced new restrictions on state hiring and employee travel. At a news conference in Anchorage, Walker said the restrictions formalize what many state agencies and departments are already doing to cut costs.
The travel is for restrictions on non-essential. An example would be a conference someplace that has to be go through a process to get approval. And there is a waiver process for that. But it has to be really associated, the travel has to be associated with what you do.
For example, Walker said essential travel would include a district attorney flying to a location for a trial. Essential travel also includes employees who need out-of-state training to maintain job credentials, although there will be a reviewing process. Boards and commissions are being asked to limit in-person meetings to once a year. Walker called this the second wave of hiring restrictions, noting that there are 600 fewer state employees than a year ago. Many of those positions were cut through attrition as employees retired. Now, no new full or part-time state positions will be added without approval. The credit rating agency Standard & Poor's downgraded Alaska today after months of warnings. With plunging oil prices wreaking havoc on the state's budget, the agency knocked the state down a notch from the top AAA rating it has held for the last 4 years. The credit rating affects how much the state and local communities have to pay to borrow money for projects like schools and roads. Today's change won't have a huge impact on the state's bottom line, but as APRN's Rachel Waldholtz reports, the downgrade came with a warning.
Okay, first things first. Alaska's credit rating is still pretty good. Standard & Poor's dropped it from a stellar AAA to a slightly less stellar AA+. For a state with a budget deficit roughly the size of a meteor, that's not too shabby. But it's not the downgrade itself that has Alaskans worried. It's the message that came along with it. Gabe Batek has been watching Alaska for about 7 years for Standard & Poor's.
The fact is, the state's trajectory is not good.
With oil prices showing no signs of rallying anytime soon, the state is facing a deficit of about $3.5 billion, or two-thirds of its operating budget, for the foreseeable future. That puts the burden on policymakers to make some radical changes.
In the big picture, it's just one notch, but if they don't make changes, there could be more downgrades to come.
A credit rating is basically an agency's best guess of the state's ability to repay its debts in full and on time. Not many states could pull off even a AA+ rating with a deficit swallowing two-thirds of its budget. The reason Alaska can are prodigious savings accounts, including the Permanent Fund. In its report, Standard & Poor's says Alaska has the financial resources to solve its budget crisis. The question is whether it has the political will. If Alaska adopts something like, say, Governor Bill Walker's plan to turn its savings into a kind of endowment, its budget outlook and credit rating could stabilize. But Petek says,
it's a lot for them to do, you know, in this one legislative session.
And if the state continues business as usual, it will burn through its savings. Meanwhile, another major ratings agency, Moody's, has continued Alaska's AAA rating. But for the last 12 months, it's attached a negative outlook, meaning there's a chance it could downgrade the state as well. Moody's analyst John Lombardi says his agency is also watching to see what lawmakers will do in Juneau this spring. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
It's an election year for U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski, and so far, no one has raised significant money to run against her. One Republican who suggested last spring that he might challenge her now says he's no longer considering it. State Senator Mike Dunleavy, a Republican from Wasilla, says his plate is already full.
We've got too many things we have to deal with here in the state of Alaska, and I got to be honest with you, you can't take your eye off the ball in this situation for a second, and so I would be doing a disservice, I think, to the people of Alaska myself. To do anything other than focus on what we have to take care of here.
So you don't intend on running for U.S. Senate in 2016?
No.
Anyone challenging Murkowski would have a steep hill to climb. Her campaign has already raised about $3 million. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service today announced that wolves in southeast Alaska do not warrant an endangered species listing. The decision comes 4 years after a petition was filed by conservation groups asking for greater protections for the wolves. KFSK's Angela Denning has more from Petersburg.
They are known as Alexander Archipelago wolves, a subspecies of the gray wolf, and range all over southeast Alaska, down to the British Columbia-Washington border. They den in the roots of large trees and prey on Sitka black-tailed deer. The population is estimated to be between 850 and 2,700 wolves, which, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, is healthy. Drew Crane is the regional endangered species coordinator.
In the majority of its range, the wolf population appears to be stable.
The agency's review compiled data on the wolf and its habitat from the U.S. Forest Service, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and British Columbia. It found that the population on Prince of Wales Island is declining, down 75% since the 1990s. Reasons for the decline include hunting, logging, and road development, which Crane says the federal government has noted.
We do have concerns for the wolf population on Prince Wales Island, but Prince Wales Island in general only constitutes, I believe, 6% of the range-wide population of the Alexander Archipelago wolf.
In other words, a decline on just one island in the wolf's total range doesn't warrant an endangered species listing.
We think that the Fish and Wildlife Service didn't get it right and that they've overlooked some important things.
That's Larry Edwards, a forest campaigner with Greenpeace. He hasn't yet read all of the 94-page decision, but says that logging and development in the region over the decades has negatively affected the wolf's habitat.
It's very odd to us that the Fish and Wildlife Services acknowledges a 75% decline in the Prince of Wales Island wolf population and then basically writes that population off.
An ESA listing could have meant greater restrictions on hunting or trapping wolves and may have impacted logging or other development. The management of the POW wolf population is the state's responsibility, and the state of Alaska thinks the feds made the right decision in not listing it. Bruce Dale is the Alaska Director of Wildlife Conservation. He says the overall population is in good shape.
There's no doubt that these populations are sound and they will persist. Throughout the area where they are distributed, they've been there for a long time, through a lot of change, and we have no concerns for this population.
The state has been keeping track of POW's wolf numbers since the late 80s, early 90s. Dale acknowledges that the population has declined substantially. The department's own study last summer found 89 wolves were on Prince of Wales and nearby islands, down from 221 the year before.
But the densities that exist still on Prince of Wales Island and in Game Management Unit number 2 there are still amongst the highest in Alaska.
He says the state will continue to keep an eye on POW's wolves and manage hunts accordingly.
We have a good bit of information on it, and that provides the ability for us to learn even more, and the management will be useful in setting appropriate harvest quotas.
The decision not to list the Alexander Archipelago wolf as endangered is the final act coming from the federal government for now. Edward says he doesn't yet know what the conservation groups will do about the new decision. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience. Through their engaging staff and faculty, APU's education is designed to broaden and deepen their students' potential through action and understanding. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by APU.
The commercial fishing industry is a huge networked system of management panels, agencies, biologists, lawmakers, processors, and somewhere in that web, individual fishermen. The Alaska Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program recognizes that fishing is a complicated business to understand and a challenging one to enter. This year, the program is hosting its sixth annual Young Fishermen Summit at the end of the month in Juneau to introduce newbies to the industry. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
It's not your grandfather's fishing industry. Alaska is a player in the international seafood market. Many people who think about getting into the game have no clue about what's at stake other than just catching fish. Sonny Rice with the Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program says the Young Fishermen Summit is about everything but the water.
Not so much about how to go out and catch fish or repair your boat, but mostly about what is the market for Alaska seafood? Why do you see one price at the dock and get a different price in the store?
Finances are a big part of the summit, managing a small business and evaluating the costs of entering new fisheries. The summit takes place in late January in Juneau at the same time as a meeting of the International Pacific Halibut Commission. The IPHC, the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, the Pacific Salmon Commission, and the Alaska Board of Fisheries all spin the threads that determine the size and shape of fishing seasons in the state. Rice says it's important that young fishermen learn the ropes of talking to these government panels. They have a workshop on just this topic.
We do something called a mock board of fish. So we'll have some of our participants actually play people who are giving testimony, and some of our participants will play board members. And they'll practice giving a 3-minute testimony. We have the light system there so they can see what it's like to have it counting down how many seconds left you have to testify. And we'll teach them about, you know, how to best compress your message into that 3 minutes that you're given.
And it's not just the incredibly complicated politics of Alaska fishing. The scientific management strategy is also daunting for newcomers. Rice says the summit incorporates a number of sessions with fishery scientists and includes a trip to the Douglas Island Pink and Chum Hatchery. So how old is too old for the Young Fisherman's Summit? Rice says young doesn't necessarily refer to a participant's age.
The bulk of our audience is people who have maybe just bought in. So you're committed to commercial fishing as a career. Some of these things are new to you.
Now in its sixth year, the summit is beginning to include presentations from alums, some of the participants from the early years who've gotten a toehold in the business and who have gained a lot of practical experience. It's a great chance to network with some of the people who are already making decisions in the industry, she says. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
A new butterfly guide is out. It identifies thousands of species across Alaska, eastern Russia, and western Canada. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, the guide also reflects the collaborative work of hundreds of scientists and amateur collectors.
Ken Phillip was a world-renowned Fairbanks butterfly expert, or lepidopterist, who passed away almost 2 years ago. He left behind a collection totaling more than 100,000 specimens. He also left unrealized a dream of producing a comprehensive guide to Alaska's butterflies and moths. Derek Sykes, a researcher and curator at the University of Alaska's Museum of the North, says friends and colleagues have stepped in to realize Phillip's dream. He says that collaborative approach is in keeping with the cadre of volunteers Phillip developed in some 50 years of research.
He had a team of between 400 and 600 people called the Alaska Lepidoptera Survey. And over the decades that Ken was working, they would send in specimens from all around the state.
Sykes says the team is still active, and Phillip's family has established an endowment to support further research. It also helped fund the new guide. He says guides are invaluable tools for amateurs and scientists alike, especially as conditions in the north shift.
We have this historical data, and now we can continue to monitor these beautiful creatures into the future and see how they change, hopefully not for the worse, but at least we'll be able to pay attention to them.
Sykes says while the bulk of Phillips' collection is headed to the Smithsonian Institution, the guide and UAF-funded awards for research ensure Phillips' legacy continues. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
This year's field for the Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race is the biggest in recent history, with over 30 competitors already signed up. One of those racers is 25-year-old Roan Boozer from Big Lake. Boozer's preparing for his sixth appearance at the K300. He finished second last year. KYUK's Charles Enoch has more.
This year, Boozer says he hopes to finish on a better note than last year.
First goal is make it to the finish line, and after that, we'll just see how well we can do. But if there's a good trail, you know, I'll work a little bit harder to stay exactly on the marked trail.
Boozer technically finished second last year after being penalized 10 minutes for veering off the trail towards the end of the race. He placed first in the K300 in 2012 and 2014, and he has never placed below sixth. Already an accomplished musher, he won the 2007 Junior Iditarod race, the Knik 200 in 2014, and the Denali doubles with his dad Martin Boozer the same year. He also raced in the Iditarod in 2008 and 2012. Boozer races for his family's Happy Trails kennel. He says he's bringing along veteran racing dogs, including a few rookies.
Some of them haven't really raced competitively very much, so it'll be exciting to see how they do.
The 36th annual Kuskokwim 300 race is scheduled to start Friday, January 15 at 6:30 p.m. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we are online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Angela Denning in Petersburg, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, and Charles Enoch in Bethel. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Mr. Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor, and I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Increase the earning power with a Bachelor of Business Administration degree with a Human Resource Management emphasis from the UAS School of Management. Details at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
If you are a rural Alaskan resident with a knowledge of regional fish and wildlife subsistence, you can apply for one of the 35 seats on your Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Councils. The council provides advice and recommendations on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing issues. Deadline to apply is Friday, January 29, 2016. Information at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco, and it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.